Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
From The Times and The Sunday Times, this is The Story. I'm Manveen Rana.
Prime Minister Modi is the boss!
World leaders treat him like a rock star.
I said to my friend the Prime Minister before, the last time I saw someone on the stage here was Bruce Springsteen, and he didn't get the welcome that Prime Minister Modi has got.
He makes tech giants like Elon Musk swoon.
He really wants to do the right thing for India. I'm a fan of Modi's.
He packs stadiums and has poll ratings that defy political gravity.
Prime Minister Modi does something which has not happened before in Indian politics among all our prime ministers. He willfully creates a cult of his own personality.
But while many see him as the strong man behind India's economic growth, others point to a growing authoritarianism, with press freedoms and free speech under attack, and opposition leaders being arrested.
That's a signature statement of this Modi government. Democracy is being assassinated.
And in a country famed for its secularism, the persecution of Muslims and religious minorities is now rife.
On the streets of the capital, Delhi, a policeman assaulted Muslims offering prayers. Just outside Goa, a Muslim man was beaten by a mob, forced to chant the name of a Hindu deity.
The biggest democratic elections the world has ever seen are currently underway in India, with 969 million voters going to the polls. Voting will continue until June. But if, as anticipated, Narendra Modi wins again, how much would a third term change India for good?
A return to power of this present government with this kind of a narrative, with this kind of a track record, it would spell disaster for India.
The story today, Modi's India, democracy under fire.
I'm Philip Sherwell, and I'm the Asia correspondent of the Sunday Times.
Narendra Modi is seeking a third term in power. You've been around India looking at how this election is playing out already. Just describe the mood there.
Well, I'd say the first thing is that India takes its elections very seriously. This is the world's largest democracy. There are some 968 million eligible voters. There'll be over 1 million polling stations. These election takes place over more than 6 weeks in 7 rounds of voting because of the sheer size of the nation. And people are very proud of what a successful sort of democratic exercise that they hold every 5 years. So there is an anticipation and an excitement, and turnout is historically high. At the last elections in 2019, it was more than 67%, a very healthy participation level. But then when you sort of talk to people in more detail, of course, there are very different views. There are the great fans of the BJP party, the ruling party of Narendra Modi, who are very confident that they're going to win a third term in office. He's going to win a third term as prime minister and are sort of looking forward to this moment. And I must say, amongst supporters of the main opposition parties nationally, that's the Congress party, the long-term dominant party in India, but now a much smaller national party, and then a series of regional parties, there is a great degree of fear and concern. They don't expect to do well, that their leaders are talking up their prospects, but supporters on the ground are very pessimistic, and they do fear deeply for the implications and ramifications of another BJP term in office. So you have a very sort of split mood in terms of how this election is going to play out in terms of the results for their respective parties.
That's so interesting. And for people who don't follow Indian politics very closely, just give us a sense. You know, you described that some people are desperate for Modi to be re-elected, some are fearful of it. Why is he so controversial? Give us a sense of the man.
He is a deeply polarizing figure as prime minister. And for his supporters, they believe he's leading an Indian rejuvenation. And I should say that means particularly for them a Hindu nationalist rejuvenation. This country is 80% Hindu. And there is a sort of belief amongst many of his supporters, his party is overtly a Hindu nationalist party, that Hindus have sort of lost out over history, be it sort of the Mughal Muslim domination of the country or the British domination, and that this is their time and their moment. And then for the opposition and many of the, overwhelmingly the country's minorities of Muslims and some Christians, there is a great concern that he is leading this sectarian sort of revival and that they're being squeezed out by this. So deeply polarizing, and that will sort of be in great evidence at the rallies and at the turnouts in coming weeks.
And you mentioned there the idea of what this sort of democratic secular India was supposed to be about. What is his ideology? What's his vision for what the country should be?
For Modi's vision now, it's really necessary to look back at his roots and his boyhood, indeed. He joined a conservative Hindu nationalist volunteer organization whose mission was to spread sort of Hindu ideology, and which organized training camps, some of which are sort of described as paramilitary, some of which are ideological. And he and many, many Indians like him joined this organization in their youth. They would go to these camps and are sort of inculcated in this principle of spreading a Hindu rights movement, and this feeling that Hindus had sort of been squeezed out after 1947, that Muslims were granted a Islamic state in Pakistan in the partition and independence from Britain, while Hindu India, predominantly Hindu India, had a secular state foisted upon it. So there's this long-running sort of resentment amongst many in India, feeling that the Hindu entity has been put upon. And he joined this organization as a volunteer. His early youth, he was an activist and joined the BJP party and became a sort of early and leading light in that. So he's been committed since his childhood to this cause, which is a vision of a strong Hindu India embracing its true religious roots as he perceives them and as many Indians perceive them, and taking a proud place on the stage, the world stage, as well as looking after its domestic religious audience.
So that's the vision he's fighting for. You've been going around India. Just take us back. There was an event in Delhi a little while ago where the host introduced someone who they described as the influencer of influencers. Just describe what was happening that evening.
Back in March last month, the event was taking place at the most prestigious sort of conference centre in Delhi. It's the one where Modi hosted leaders from the G20 last year. And it was an event called the National Creators Awards.
I'm honoured to introduce the next person on the stage who needs no introduction.
And this was specifically to promote and honour, as the terminology went, social media influencers. Yeah, so you had this sort of stellar array of young Indian social media celebrities with millions of followers on Instagram and other apps. But here they were paying tribute to Modi because he and his party have really recognized and embraced the power of technology and the digital world to spread their message.
When he tweets, he becomes a trend. When he goes on a radio show, he becomes the world's number one radio show.
He does not ride the trend, he is the trend.
When Modi was first running for the top job, the prime minister role, 10 years ago, much of the mainstream media was highly critical of his and the BJP's agenda. And the way they sort of realized at an early stage to get around this was that they could use social media to sort of talk directly to the electorate they were trying to appeal to. And 10 years later, you know, Modi and the BJP's tech team are seen as masters of this craft. And Modi was here being sort of hailed on stage for the fact that it's his posts that go viral and his reels that attract huge numbers of hits.
Ladies and gentlemen, join your hands together for the influencer of the influencers, the OG, the GOAT.
And indeed, as the speaker described him, he was the influencer of the influencers. He was the one they look up to as the man who really gets his message across and is the exemplar of spreading the word.
What is it about Narendra Modi that makes him such an influencer, that makes his posts the most clicked on?
He's massively helped by the experience of the BJP's IT cell, that's their information technology cell, who've really managed to sort of harness all these different aspects of social media. He seldom gives media interviews, and certainly he doesn't give interviews to media who might be critical, ask him difficult questions, and nor does he ever take or ever give press conferences. So for him and for his party's information technology cell, the use of social media is absolutely how they control their message. And, you know, you might look across to Donald Trump in America and how he's created his own sort of social media empire to deal with a critical press there. And you would sort of recognize similarities, but Narendra Modi and the BJP were in there first.
And Modi's become very good at knowing how to come up with a political stunt almost that is very good at grabbing attention again, in the way that an influencer would, I suppose. Just tell us about one of the recent ones, which involved him diving underwater.
There's a Hindu holy city in his home state of Gujarat, and part of the city has now fallen into the Arabian Sea and has been excavated by underwater archaeologists in recent years. And he dived to a site there in a, needless to say, much photographed and videoed moment, and was seen having a reflective moment on the seabed. He would, of course, say there's nothing stunt-like about it. He says it is a decades-long dream of his to actually sort of see this location. But nonetheless, it achieved huge attention and a much better focus than maybe if he'd been being asked questions by troublesome journalists in a way he wouldn't like.
And that wasn't the first time he's used an image like that. In the lead up to election year, he's also been involved with a much more controversial temple. Tell us about that.
In January this year, he inaugurated a new Hindu temple to the deity Ram in Ayodhya in Uttar Pradesh. And this is at a location that Hindus believe is the birthplace of Ram. But also the location of that temple is on the grounds of a Muslim mosque that was destroyed by rioters in 1992, rioters who went on the rampage after addresses by several Hindu nationalist leaders, including BJP leaders of that era. It's been a long-term commitment to the BJP to build a temple on this site. They say there was a temple there before the mosque was built in the 16th century. That is disputed, but nonetheless, it's a location of great symbolic importance for Hindus, a great spiritual importance for Hindus.
Siyavara Ramachandra ki jai. Siyavar Ramachandra ki jai.
The opposition leaders boycotted the inauguration. They didn't accept the invitations to attend because they said it was a political event, but achieved huge attention. There have been millions of pilgrims have gone to Ayodhya in the weeks since it was opened. And I spoke to one BJP strategist who said in the north of India, in the Hindu heartlands. He thought that there would be a 10 to 15% boost in the BJP vote just because of the Ayodhya temple issue.
And in terms of his role as an influencer in the run-up to an election, he seems to have cracked how to reach as many people as possible. And I understand a lot of this is being done by his own IT cell. How does that work?
The party's IT cell was described to me by one sort of analyst as being operating the Amazon of political messaging operations, that they were using all forms of social media to get their message across. They would use the short video aspect on Instagram called Reels to get sort of quick, buzzy messages across, showing rallies and crowds. They would use Twitter to get more elaborate messages across. So if you get something out on Twitter, it then sort of gets into the echo chamber and reverberates out. They would use Facebook to sort of put more detailed stories out. So they really are using all these sort of different social media platforms and have adopted a very sort of sophisticated approach. It's all focused around Modi and policies, Modi and government, NAMO, as he's termed as a shortening for Narendra Modi, NAMO, hashtag this, hashtag that, Modi's face. And certainly in their armory in this election, it's a very important element to explain their strength and the reason that they're the clear favourites to emerge as winners when the count is completed on June the 4th.
And Philip, you actually met somebody who's part of the party's IT operation down in Hyderabad. Tell us a bit about him and how he's involved. What does he do?
Yeah, so I met Suresh Kochatil. He's a former media executive. He's sort of a cosmopolitan, sort of sophisticated figure. He's worked abroad, but he also, is a long-time activist. He's 62 now, and he's now a veteran of these social media wars. And he helps advise influencers who are pro-BJP on putting out messages. He's part of the IT cell sort of messaging WhatsApp groups that receive instructions from Delhi on what messages they want to put out in a particular day, what stories to highlight. He sends back feedback on what's doing well in the south. He's based in Hyderabad, but I mean, he's got a role across the south of India. And so he's a sort of typical figure in this social media sort of armory and empire that they deploy.
And how effective has it been? Is the digital political messaging working across the country?
Social media is a key political weapon for the BJP, and to sort of separate it out from the other parts of the BJP message might be difficult. But if you're looking at the overall package of BJP policies, Hindu nationalists, mantras, social media messaging, it all works together. And it's very doubtful that they would be such a dominant force without having such a strong grip on how they spread the message.
So aggressive social media tactics have earned Narendra Modi millions of followers and a huge support base. But what about the voices of those in India who don't agree with him?
Several opposition leaders have had corruption investigations launched against them.
Coming up, how Narendra Modi silences his critics.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Transitioning to a decarbonised economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organisation and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
Philip, you've been describing how Narendra Modi is using typical influencer tactics, really, using the internet, using technology to reach the electorate. Tell us a bit about the people who oppose him. Tell us about some of his critics, perhaps starting with Arvind Kejriwal.
Yes, so Arvind Kejriwal is the Chief Minister of Delhi. He leads an opposition party which grew out of an anti-corruption movement of activists and is in power in Delhi and in Punjab in the north. Kejriwal is currently behind bars. He was arrested. He's being investigated for alleged corruption and money laundering offences to do with government custom excise policy. And he will actually, at least for the start of Voting India, he will be behind bars in prison after a court decided this week that he couldn't be released pending the investigating authorities bringing their case before the justices at the end of April. Now, Kejriwal is seen as just one example of what has happened to many opposition politicians who found themselves under investigation for alleged tax and corruption offences. And the opposition do claim that the government is using these investigations for political purposes. The government insists in turn that the investigations are neutral and are simply being conducted to meet the requirements of law enforcement.
And he's not the only opposition figure who Narendra Modi seems to have gone after with the threats of the law.
Several opposition leaders have had corruption investigations launched against them. And it's also interesting that at lower state levels, a number of opposition politicians who've defected to join the BJP have had corruption investigations into them dropped. So the opposition certainly see this as a widespread tactic that is part of the attempt to intimidate and defeat and undermine their sort of cause before voting even starts.
I mean, being able to use the law like that to undermine the opposition when you're in an election year, it does feel very authoritarian. How is he doing on other fronts where you'd sort of measure how authoritarian a country is? I mean, like, what's press freedom like?
Press freedom rankings have gone way down during his decade in power. It's a twist that when he and the BJP were sort of running the 2014 campaign when he came to power, they were using social media to get around what's been termed the mainstream media, or the traditional media, legacy media, because those outlets were largely sceptical or critical of his cause. Now, many of the major TV and media outlets are very vocal supporters of Modi. And journalists who've written critical articles often complain that they find it very difficult now to even find an outlet to work for, because such is the mood that media organisations have fallen in behind the power of the ruling party.
And he's done other things which are sort of controversial and seen as being quite authoritarian or anti-democratic. Tell us a bit about his citizenship law.
Just last month, the government announced that it was going to put into force a very controversial new Citizenship Amendment Act.
Sporadic protests have erupted in India against a citizenship law that has been criticised for discriminating against Muslims. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government implemented the controversial legislation just days before a general election is announced.
This was actually passed in 2019, and it means that refugees from neighbouring countries such as Afghanistan and Bangladesh who are not Muslims can apply for Indian citizenship. But Muslim refugees and incomers from those countries cannot. And the Indian constitution forbids discrimination on the basis of religion. And this is widely viewed by his critics to be a discriminatory law. It's been criticized by the United Nations and several foreign powers. India, for its part, says that these are for refugees from neighboring Muslim countries. So it's by the nature of the law, they're looking to protect religious minorities from Muslim countries. So these are non-Muslim individuals. So they defend it as their right to employ their laws to give citizenships to those who they choose to give them to. But the fact that the law has only now just been implemented in the days before this election has certainly fueled criticisms that they are playing the Muslim religion card to encourage their faithful at a time when the elections loom.
So, opposition figures either behind bars or with the threat of being arrested looming over them. You've got press freedom going down. You have the citizenship law, which gives selective citizenship based on religion. How is that all going down in India? Just talk us through what people think of Modi.
Yes, when I was in Hyderabad, I spoke to a computer software engineer called Charan. He's 35. Basically, his professional life has been over the last 10 years when Modi has been in power. He's done very well in that decade. And, you know, as India has grown in recent years, its economy and particularly its digital sector. And you might have thought he'd be sort of viewing himself as a beneficiary of that India, but he is, he is a Hindu. He's from the, majority Hindu population in India. But I mean, he finds the BJP's divisive politics extremely distasteful. He feels that Indians are being turned against Indians. He feels that Muslims are being unfairly targeted. And he just feels that India is a more tolerant country than Modi represents. And he will certainly not be voting for Modi, even though he's someone who's done very well during Modi's years.
So that's how people who are economically successful but more liberal feel. What about some of his supporters?
The supporters, and let's make it clear, Modi has an incredibly stellar personal approval rating. I mean, you know, opinion polls consistently give him approval of above 70%, because there is a lot that his, you know, we've talked here about the sorts of issues that exercise sort of opposition politicians and, you know, maybe journalists and campaigners on human rights issues. But there is a lot of very sort of practical policies that have been introduced under the BJP that have benefited large swathes of the population. He's built toilets across the country, or his government has built toilets across the country that mean that people in sort of poorer areas, in villages, in rural India, who often had no access to that sort of sanitation, now can use toilets and are not having to go to the fields for that purpose. His government has overseen a major digitalization policy that means even in the smallest corners of rural India, people can access the financial systems, they can transfer money, they can receive money from relatives working in the big cities, you know, through a top couple of buttons on their telephones rather than having to get the money through brokers and often losing, you know, money to expensive fees or corruption. So there's a lot of sort of practical policies that the BJP have pursued. They're overseeing a big infrastructure boom. The economy is performing extremely well if you look at GDP growth figures, and it's the fastest growing of the major economies in the world. Now, if you drill down on where the economy is really struggling is to produce enough jobs for young Indians. But there is a overall perception that the economy is strong. There was also much excitement in India last year at the landing of a spacecraft on the moon, which also sort of gave this feeling that of bolstering national pride, of this sense of rejuvenation, of this sense of India being a leading force, reflecting its population and its size. So when people look at what's actually happening under this government, many Indians feel they've benefited from life under the BJP. They will also be attracted by that Hindu nationalist message, but they will also look at practical benefits. That's one of the factors why Modi has such a large support base.
Philip, if Modi does win this election, what would that mean for India? What would a third term of Modi look like?
Well, Modi is in that somewhat rare thing around the world at the moment, is successfully an incumbent promising at one level, more of the same. And in a world where there is a sort of often an anti-incumbency spirit, it's interesting that that in India, he's actually riding on the back of that, and that amongst his supporters, they want a sort of this Indian rejuvenation, this stronger India and stronger Hindu India message to be pursued. One of the BJP's ambitions in this election is to hit more than 400 seats in a parliament of 543. They and their smaller allies currently have 353 seats, and they've set their goal on 400 plus. And there is, although they haven't voiced this directly as a party policy, there is a belief amongst and a hope amongst BJP supporters and a fear and a concern amongst the opposition that one of the things they'll try to do with that sort of majority in parliament is to actually change India's secular constitutional status. Many Hindu activists have long wanted India to be defined as a Hindu state. They look across the border at Pakistan as a openly an Islamic republic, and they want India to be a Hindu state. And there is a sort of belief on both sides that if the BJP and its allies have a large enough majority in parliament, that that might be one mission they would pursue. Amongst the regional states, particularly in the south, where Hindi is not widely spoken and where it's certainly not the first language, there is also a concern that Hindi could be imposed. Although 80% of Indians are Hindu, only about half that number actually speak Hindi as their first tongue. But it is very much the language of Modi and the BJP and their message.
So this could be the end of secular India. It could mean one national language everybody has to speak. Philip, you began this interview by talking about India as the biggest democracy in the world. Would it also challenge that title? Would it be less democratic?
Well, India will continue to hold the largest elections, and the governments will continue, I'm sure, to be elected at the ballot box. So to that extent, it will maintain that status as the largest democracy. But activists and campaigners will then sort of drill down on aspects of how democratic India is when the law, as they would argue, is being used to jail opposition leaders, when the media is dominated by pro-BJP forces, and when social media is being used to whip up and foment religious tensions and, you know, extremely sort of hate-filled, as they would say, views of the country's Muslim minority. So democracy, largest democracy, yes. Whether it's a sunny example of a democratic country in operation is highly disputed by Indians.
That was Philip Sherwell, Asia correspondent for the Sunday Times. The Indian election lasts for 44 days, and Philip will be in India covering every twist and turn. You can find all the latest at thetimes.co.uk with a subscription. The producer today was Priyanka Dilardia. The executive producer was Kate Ford. And sound design and theme tune were by Mal Lacerto. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.
Transitioning to a decarbonised economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organisation and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts, or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.